The Naples Council on World Affairs is pleased to welcome Dr. Eugene Roemer, the Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Dr. Roemer has a BA from Boston University, an MA from Georgetown University, and holds a doctorate from MIT. His distinguished career includes service in government, academia, and think tanks. In government, he served on the staff of the National Security Council, at the Department of State, at the National Defense University, and as a staff member of the NIC, the U.S. National Intelligence Council. He has taught at Georgetown and at the George Washington University, and has had appointments at RAND and the Institute for International Strategic Studies, in addition to his current position at the Carnegie Endowment. Dr. Roemer is the author of several books, including Russian Foreign Policy Beyond Putin and Central Asia, Views from Washington, Moscow, and Beijing. In addition, he has authored scholarly articles for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and other organizations. He has produced many such articles for Carnegie, including Russia is Winning, or Is It? And a very timely article titled, The INF Treaty is Doomed. We Need a New Arms Control Framework. Given Vladimir Putin's ambitions, Dr. Roemer's subject, Russia Rising, could not be more important, nor could it be more timely. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Eugene Roemer.
Once again, thank you, Bill, for this exceedingly generous introduction. You've listed so many of my previous occupations and affiliations that some people might think that I can't hold down a job. I've been very happily employed at Carnegie for the past 5 years. Some of my remarks, really my remarks tonight, derived from the work that I'm doing with Carnegie colleagues, trying to rethink, reconceptualize our bilateral relationship with Russia as it has evolved over the past 30 years, what risen Russia is likely to mean for the United States, for our national security. And indeed, I think, as the title of the talk says, Russia is rising, and we're seeing the evidence of Russia's new global reach in places as near to the Russian heartland as the Baltic countries or Ukraine, where Russia has been involved for the past 5 years or so in an undeclared war against the independent Ukrainian government. We see Russian airplanes and boots on the ground in Syria, where Russia has practically, not overnight, but in a short period of time, reversed the course of a civil war and saved its client regime of Bashar al-Assad from almost a certain collapse. And most recently, we see Russian presence in this hemisphere, not just in Cuba, with which Russia has had a long-standing relationship, and not just in our domestic politics, where it came as a shock, but by now has become a staple of our domestic political discourse, but in Venezuela, where when President Trump mentions the possibility of introducing American military in Venezuela to deal with the Maduro government, President Putin says that you better not do it. And as we now know, Russia has been involved in Venezuelan affairs for the past almost 10 years, and in the past several years has been basically the lender of last resort for the perennially broke Maduro government. And earlier last year, Russian long-range bombers conducted an overflight and landed in Venezuela, and the commander of the Russian Air Force even mentioned the possibility of establishing a Russian air base in Venezuela. Now, to those of you old enough, and I'm sure almost everyone here is, with perhaps with the exception of a few people on the front bench, this brings back memories of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the time when Russia and the United States were on the brink of a war. And certainly, and not just Russia and the United States were on the brink of a war, we were on the brink of a nuclear Armageddon. But all of this really, in a way, comes to us as a surprise, because certainly we didn't expect the relationship to turn out the way it has. When, seemingly not that long ago, the Soviet Union peacefully came apart, the Berlin Wall came down, and the Cold War ended. And our relationship with Russia, first the Soviet Union, then Russia, after 1991, really appeared to us in very positive, almost rosy hues. We expected that we would become partners, almost allies, with the new democratic, market-oriented Russia. And I think if we are to answer the question of how did we end up, what has been our progression, if you call it that, or regression, from the time of such optimism when President George H.W. Bush talked about his hope for building a productive partnership with Russia in his State of the Union address in 1991, to the time when now Russia has been declared practically our enemy number one, a country that has blatantly interfered in our domestic affairs, and a country that seems to be getting in our way anywhere we look. How did it happen? What happened over the past 30 years or so that perhaps we missed, that perhaps we didn't do quite right? Because after all, this is not to whitewash anything the Russians have done in Europe, in Georgia, in Ukraine, in the United States, and so on. But as the saying goes, it always takes two to tango. And I think we have to ask ourselves, were those initial expectations inflated, overly optimistic? Did we do something along these lines, perhaps that probably wasn't warranted, and so on? So let's go back to the early 1990s and the time of hope and optimism, and quickly, telegraphically, since I don't have many hours here at the podium, review how the relationship has evolved. And if you look at basically the three phases in this relationship, and those are the three consecutive presidencies of President Bill Clinton, of President George W. Bush, and of President Barack Obama, we have gone through several cycles in this relationship that essentially have followed the same pattern of beginning with a boom and ending with a bust. So back to, let's say, 1992, 1993, when President Clinton comes into the White House and realizes that the relationship with Russia, and his administration realizes at the time, that the relationship with Russia really is not living up to its full potential, that we need to do more. So soon after the inauguration in January of 1993, jump to March of 1993, President Clinton meets with President Boris Yeltsin of Russia in Vancouver. And it truly is a historic event, both in terms of the kinds of commitments and promises that are made at that event, and in terms of the personal relationship that the two leaders strike with each other. They go into it as Presidents Boris Yeltsin and Bill Clinton, and they come out as Bill and Boris. And this Bill-Boris relationship is what really carries the bilateral relationship to a very large extent through the next 8 years. And they announced that Russia and the United States have formed a partnership for reform, democratic reform, market reform, and the United States will now be deeply involved in Russia's domestic affairs, helping Russia build political parties, helping Russia build its market economy, advising the Russian finance ministry how to organize its accounts, advising the Russian privatization ministry how to conduct the privatization. And Russia said that we'll accept all this help gratefully, we'll follow the path of democracy, we'll follow the path of market reform, and we'll be good citizens on the world stage, respecting the rights of our neighbors, especially those that are in our immediate vicinity, countries like Ukraine, Georgia, Belarus, Moldova, and so on. And this is a very optimistic time. And we sort of go in full force, and American advisors arrive, and we do all these things that we said we would do. But along the way, we're beginning to realize reasonably quickly, as early as 1994, 1995, 1996, that there's some clouds over this relationship that began with such youthful vigor and optimism. What are those clouds? Well, Russia is not doing as well as we hoped it would on democracy. Yeltsin turns out to be not as much of a democrat as he was. He does this thing in Moscow, remember, in 1993, when he ordered his tanks to fire on the rebellious parliament. He conducts a very brutal campaign in the breakaway Republic of Chechnya in the South Caucasus that costs thousands upon thousands of civilian lives. And he is beginning to muscle in on the neighbors, on Georgia, on Ukraine. He's refusing to pull troops back from Moldova, and so on. And the version of capitalism that is emerging in Russia is not the kind of clean, orderly capitalism that we thought it would be. It becomes a pretty corrupt, what we now call crony capitalism, in which a relatively small segment of the Russian elite have captured the commanding heights of the Russian economy and have abused that access to the Kremlin, including to members of Mr. Yeltsin's immediate family. In fact, at the time, the ruling elite in Moscow was referred to as the family, and it really meant Mr. Yeltsin, his daughter Tatiana, who was his principal political advisor, her soon-to-be husband, and a few close associates. And they basically doled out the goodies in exchange for political favors and so on. So it's not exactly the pristine model that we hoped Russia would become. And on the foreign policy front, beyond just muscling in on the immediate neighbors, Russia is really unhappy with something that we're doing in Eastern Europe and beyond. The big sticking issue that emerges in the bilateral relationship between us and Russia is the expansion of NATO. The first round of invitations goes out in 1997, and the Russians are very, very unhappy about that, that Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary will join the alliance. Those countries were previously part of the Warsaw Pact, part of the outer layer of the Soviet Empire. Now they're going to be the edge of the Western empires, the Russian seed, hostile to them. So this frustration continues to build up. There is the campaign in Kosovo in 1999, when Russia reacts rhetorically, vehemently, to what they see as American unilateral application of its air power against a long-standing ally, Serbia. And it's the time when Russian and American militaries almost come to blows in Pristina, when a small detachment of Russian troops rushes to the airport to Pristina to get in the way of American operations there. Luckily, the crisis was avoided through a lot of very patient and careful American diplomacy. But these are the kinds of things that are not to be swept under the carpet, cannot be ignored, and they're having their impact on the relationship. So while Bill and Boris can get together and say good things at their summits about each other, The reality is the relationship really is sputtering. And actually, by the time the Clinton administration's time in office is over, the end of 2000, the relationship, by all accounts, is at its lowest point since the end of Cold War II. So then we have the presidency, and so we went from a boom to a bust. Then you have the presidency of George W. Bush. And initially, the Bush 43 administration was not particularly enamored of Russia, especially after Boris Yeltsin handed over the presidency to this little-known former KGB colonel by the name of Vladimir Putin. They felt that it was a KGB thug who is now in charge of Russia, came to power in undemocratic ways. But pretty quickly, they decide that it's better to have Russia in the tent than outside the tent. And we have that first meeting between President George W. Bush and Vladimir Putin in June of 2001 in Ljubljana, Slovenia. And Mr. Bush then uttered those words that I'm sure he regrets to the present day about looking into Putin's eyes and seeing his soul. They begin again on a positive note. In 2002, they meet again. Putin comes to the United States, and they announce a partnership. And once again, it's a partnership that has market democracy, so spreading the two the world over and so on, very much kind of ingrained into the nature of that partnership. There are specific aspects of it that are announced, such as, you know, a partnership for energy security. And of course, the United States wants Russia to be a partner in its global war on terror, because this, after all, is after 9/11. But as they announce this partnership, there are growing frustrations appearing on both sides as early as 2002, 2003. Why? Well, because Putin is once again backsliding on democracy. Despite the promises made at the outset that this partnership will respect democratic norms and values and so on, Putin does not seem to deliver. On his watch, Russia continues to muscle in on countries in the neighborhood that we consider friendly. We have a significant confrontation with the Russians over the so-called Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004. In which our political candidate, our favorite pro-democracy, pro-reform, pro-Western candidate, Viktor Yushchenko, is competing with Moscow's crony capitalism, anti-democracy candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, the battle of two victors. And in the end, our guy wins at the polls that are dirty but competitive nonetheless, sort of the norm for Ukrainian politics. And the Russians are deeply frustrated by the fact that the Americans succeeded in getting their guy in charge in Ukraine. And they're certainly not going to settle for it. If given a chance, they'll push back. And they continue to push back, squeezing Ukraine, squeezing Georgia, using the energy diplomacy, so to speak. If you don't do what we say, we'll cut off your gas deliveries, something they've done on multiple occasions with Georgia and on several occasions with Ukraine. They keep doing this. We're unhappy about it. We continue to tell the Russians they shouldn't do that. The Russians keep telling us you shouldn't be meddling and promoting democracy in what is our sphere of influence around our periphery. After all, this neighborhood has been part of our history much longer than it has been of yours. And then the next round of NATO enlargement comes about in 2004. Now we have taken in three Baltic republics, previously part of the Soviet Union, never recognized by us as part of the Soviet Union, but nonetheless. So now you have NATO countries within a relatively short driving distance of St. Petersburg, 2 or 3 hours, which is the second biggest, most important Russian city, the second capital of the country. Mr. Putin's hometown, by the way. And Mr. Putin continues to press his case that NATO enlargement is not something that Russia will ever come to terms with, especially as it begins to encroach upon the territories that Russia considers to be its significant area of interest, the exclusive area of interest. And the culmination really occurs in 2008. In March of 2008, at the NATO summit in Bucharest, NATO, prompted by the United States, despite German opposition, promises Georgia and Ukraine that they will be admitted into NATO. Now, think for a moment what Georgia had been part of the Russian Empire since around 1800. Ukraine had been part of the Russian Empire since around 1654, I think. Eastern Ukraine traditionally developed as part of the Russian industrial heartland. For the Russian security establishment, steeped sort of in the culture and traditions of the Soviet and Russian Empire, to consider the thought of Ukraine and Georgia joining what they considered to be a hostile alliance was an unacceptable move, and they promptly acted on it in the summer of 2008, in August, when Russia invaded Georgia, crushed it militarily. It was just a matter of a few days, considering especially the size of Georgia and the size of Russia, and made very clear that NATO expansion, eastward NATO expansion, was not to be anymore. And then, of course, toward the end of the Bush administration, despite the occasional positive relationship between the president and Putin, once again ends in a bust. On to the Obama administration, which inherits the relationship in a terrible shape. And they realize that, you know, as bad as Russia is, but a number of issues that are important to the United States at the time, you have to deal with Russia. You can't get around it. One of those issues that stands out more than others is the issue of Iran's WMD. And you can't solve, if you can solve, the issue of Iran's WMD by peaceful means, by negotiated means, you have to have Russia at the table. Because Russia is part of the Security Council, because Russia has had a long-established relationship with Iran, and basically has secured its position as a political patron protector of the Iranian regime on the world stage. So you need to have some kind of a conversation with Russia. President Obama, too, wants to have more arms control and cut back strategic systems. So you need to talk to the Russians, because if you can't talk to them, you can't have an arms control treaty with them. So the two meet, the two being President Obama and, at the time, new president of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev, who temporarily took over the presidency from Vladimir Putin, who was, by the term of the Russian Constitution, not allowed to serve two consecutive terms. They meet, they hit it off. I don't know if they become Barry and Dima, those are the short names for, I suppose, but they hit it off. There's certainly some personal chemistry there. Obama travels to Russia later in 2009, and they announce a partnership for modernization. Modernization being more democracy in Russia, more market, more transformation of the Russian economy. Medvedev in particular was very taken with technological developments, wants to create a Silicon Valley in Russia. And he wants to have American industry, American entrepreneurs, American technology there. And for a while it continues okay. It goes on okay. They seem to be getting along. But unfortunately, Medvedev's term expires in 2012, before they've completed their modernization, before Russia has been modernized into a full-fledged diversified market economy and a properly functioning democratic society. And Who comes back? Vladimir Putin. Putin is not enamored of modernization. Putin is not enamored of democracy. In fact, Putin's return is accompanied by significant protests, and Putin evidently decides that it's Medvedev's political thaw and talk of modernization that are the root causes of this political protest that have inflated the expectations of some Russians for political change at home. And he cracks down repeatedly, systematically. In fact, his entire term since 2012 to 2018, now he's been reelected again, was basically a record of more and more cracking down on domestic dissent. Quite successfully, I might say. He has extinguished quite a bit of it, most of it. And he comes in for very sharp criticism from the West for his handling of Russian domestic politics. And then when the revolution in Ukraine occurs and he annexes a portion of Ukrainian territory, Crimea, and unleashes an undeclared war in eastern Ukraine that still continues, he sort of completes the trifecta of a corrupt economy, an authoritarian domestic political system, and aggressive behavior on the world stage. Aggressive behavior that, in the Russian narrative, is prompted to a very large extent by Western promises of NATO membership and NATO security guarantees to NATO. So once again, by the time Donald Trump is elected, the relationship between Russia and the United States has gone from boom to bust. And once again, it's at its worst in 30 years since the end of the Cold War. Now, on to briefly the Trump administration. And, you know, being a sort of a paid-for denizen of the 1700 block of Massachusetts Avenue, where your previous speaker, Michael O'Hanlon, works by day, where I work by day, and where your next speaker from the American Enterprise Institute works by day, I'm not a big fan of President Trump. But he's not popular on the block of Massachusetts Avenue in Washington where I work. But I think, to give credit where it's due, the Trump presidency, perhaps Trump personally, but sort of issues that have come to the fore in his foreign policy are issues that I think we have put aside for quite a long time and really need to address as a nation, as voters. I honestly don't expect that these questions will come up, let alone be resolved in our political and public policy discourse before 2021, assuming there is a new administration in the White House in 2021. I think for the time being, our conversation about Russia is so politicized that it's almost impossible to have a sane conversation about what our stakes are in that country and in that bilateral relationship. But President Trump has raised a number of issues that I think should be addressed. Why not have a good relationship with Putin? What is the price that we should be prepared to pay for a good relationship with Russia? How committed should we be to promoting democracy, as several previous administrations have done, in Ukraine, in Georgia, in Central Asia, elsewhere? Those are the areas that are of immediate relevance to the bilateral U.S.-Russian relationship. Was, for example, in 2012 and 13 and 14 and so on, our insistence as the conflict was escalating in Syria, our insistence that Assad must go, which was a red line for the Russians, and it was for us, was that absolutely the necessary requirement for peace in Syria and possibly more broadly in the Middle East. Looking back, and I think it's one of the most difficult issues to address, and it's related to the question of democracy. NATO, after 2008, after promising membership in the alliance to Georgia and Ukraine, has basically adopted an open-door policy. Is that correct? Now, in the past several years, we have admitted countries that we never thought were essential to the security of the alliance, or really seriously wanted membership in it. Why are countries that are hard to believe will ever contribute significantly to the security of the alliance? Montenegro, Albania. It seems like they are geographically and otherwise peripheral to the alliance and to its primary areas of concern. And how important is it to us that Georgia be admitted to NATO? How important is it that NATO have an open door? The alliance was never intended to have an open door for anyone to walk in. And even in 1995, when NATO conducted its official study on enlargement, one of the conditions for it was, look it up, it's on the NATO webpage. One of the conditions was that membership, admission of new members should benefit the security of the alliance. So then the question is, does prospective membership for Georgia and Ukraine that are so neuralgic to Russia, is that something that really is in our interest? Does it benefit our allies in Europe? Is it the right move? They seem like somewhat abstract questions at the moment when we're consumed by questions about Russian involvement in our elections and the Mueller investigation and collusion that wasn't there and so on. But I think those are some of the fundamental questions in our foreign policy. Trump questions our commitment to NATO. And I think a lot of this is more broadly driven by this kind of overly ambitious, expansive agenda that we ascribed to NATO in the 1990s when the world seemed to be ours and our victory in the Cold War seemed to be irreversible, and it seemed like nothing could ever alter that. So, you know, Russia is rising. It's not an aberration. I think to a very large extent, it's Russia's return to norm. Russia is not going to be another Soviet Union, but it will remain an important actor on the world stage. And we need to recognize that they have different priorities, they have different interests that are derived, like our priorities and interests are derived from our history, our culture, our strategic culture, our geography. The same applies to them. And I fear that's something that we haven't paid a whole lot of attention to in the past 25, 30 years. So I am out of time, but just in closing, I want to repeat a few questions that I think we as citizens, as voters, should really ask ourselves as we think about our foreign policy for the next 4 years. How important is it to us that Russia be democratic? Can we deal with a Russia that is not democratic? How important is it that we completely reject Russia's sphere of influence and insist on membership for Georgia and Ukraine in the alliance? We don't need to surrender those two countries to Russia's sphere of influence, but should we be making promises to them that very clearly we cannot sustain? And, you know, is it possible that in some areas where we have common interests that may not fully conform to our principles, we may find some common understanding with the Russians that would constitute a compromise? I think I'll stop at that and turn it back over to our chairman for the Q&A. And thank you very much once again for having me here. I've really enjoyed your hospitality, and it's really inspiring to see so many interested people at a time when I think, you know, foreign policy just takes a backseat to a lot of our domestic concerns. So thank you.
As usual, we have mics set up in each of the aisles. Those with questions, please come to the mic. Sir.
Yes. One of the questions I have is the position in the Mediterranean. Russia used to have bases in Libya, in Egypt, and in Syria. And I thought, and my impression was that the loss of Egypt and Libya, that Syria became very important to them to have at least one warm water base in Syria. What do you feel about that issue?
I agree. I could stop right here, but let me just, you know, expound a little bit more. Excuse me. Yes, Russia did have for a while, the Soviet Union did have for a while, a much more robust presence around the Mediterranean. In, you know, they had a very strong relationship with Egypt from the 1950s until, I think, Sadat expelled them in the early 80s, if I'm not mistaken. They had a client-patron relationship, or patron-client, rather, relationship with Gaddafi. And they had security relationships with a number of countries in North Africa through their arms sales, through their support, via technical advisors. They took in students for their military academies and so on. So absolutely, they had a much bigger presence. And they're working on rebuilding that presence now. They have engaged with President Sisi. Putin personally has engaged with him, and there have been a number of bilateral visits. They signed a weapons deal. Some people question where the Egyptians will get the money to pay for those weapons. And they suspect that maybe the Saudis will pay for it. I have no insight into that, but the Russians have pursued that avenue as well. They have conducted joint exercises, and they have a shared interest in the neighboring Libya, which has been in a state more or less of a civil war on again, off again, since the fall of Gaddafi, or the Russians would say the overthrow of Gaddafi by the United States. That's something that they deeply resent, the campaign against Libya, against Gaddafi by us. That's something they deeply resent, and they cite as an example of democracy promotion by the United States at the tip of American bayonets that resulted in complete chaos in a previously orderly country. I don't want to go there, but that's just sort of their interpretation. They have been building ties to a variety of Libyan factions, most prominently of one warlord, General Khalifa Haftar. And I think they're looking to secure their presence there, which of course would transform, if you look at the map of the Med, would really enhance their presence, even if it's not a very significant military presence. With air and air defense assets deployed there, they could become a factor in the way the Sixth Fleet operates there, probably. That's my kind of layperson's assessment, but yeah, they're working on it. Yeah.
Next question, please.
Yes, how do the realities of the Russian economy impede Vladimir Putin's grander design, or shall we say interact with his grand designs?
Yeah. Well, it would seem on the surface that the limited size of the Russian economy, which is about 1/10 of our economy, puts a cap on his ambitions. But it's a more complicated question than that. So there has not been a direct correlation between Putin's economic difficulties and Russian activism on the world stage. If anything, I would say since 2014, when the price of oil collapsed and the Russian currency lost half its value, which caused a real crisis for the Russian economy, Putin has become more aggressive or dynamic, however you want to call it, and he carried out a military intervention in Syria, which proved to be quite successful. I think he realizes the limitations that the size of the economy imposes on him. I think, to give them credit, they've been quite judicious in their application of military power and various ventures they involved themselves in farther away. A lot of their activity, to give you an example, they signed in 2015, I think, a $75 billion deal with the government of South African President Jacob Zuma, then President Jacob Zuma, to build a series of nuclear power plants in South Africa. Now, that was really a commercial venture for which South Africa would pay, but with clearly strategic implications. Now, if you look up Zuma's biography, you find out that in addition to being extremely corrupt, he also was in charge of ANC intelligence, and he was trained in the Soviet Union. So those old era Cold War era ties persist. The Russians capitalize on those, and they seek opportunities to become enmeshed, involved in countries for the long term, but without really committing a whole lot of resources. I've been quite clear about that.
Sir.
Thanks for your description of the yo-yo that we've been on through three presidents, which we look at basically as the Russians are looking at us through NATO and Europe. How do you feel as they now start to look further east and how they might be assessing us, or we them, through the eyes of Beijing and Moscow? As Russia builds more of a relationship going toward the Chinese, how do you feel that that's going to implicate us as opposed to all this activity through Europe and NATO?
How do I feel? I believe that the relationship between the partnership, really, strategic partnership between Russia and China is very real. It's not just something that has occurred as a result of the break with the West. It's been in the works for 25 years or so, going back to the Yeltsin years, or even Gorbachev years. I think it's a win-win for both. It certainly has accelerated since 2014, the break with the West. But it's a genuine partnership. I think each side has determined that it has, on balance, a lot to gain from it. One of the big things that unites them is their shared opposition to the United States. And one of the benefits they derive is the ability to act in concert to counter the United States on a world stage. Yeah, I can talk more about sort of economic issues, but basically Russia is a junior partner with China. They know it. They accept it. They're prepared to live with it. They realize they can't change that, making the most of it.
Next question here, please.
Any comments on the significance of the unrecorded meetings that Trump had with Putin?
It's a scandal. I don't know beyond that, you know. When in my now long time ago time on the National Security Council staff, there were always note takers. There were always transcripts. If anything, for the historical record. By the way, the Clinton Library has declassified a fascinating collection of presidential communications between Clinton and Yeltsin, and you can find it on the web. It's in the Clinton Library archives. And if you're interested, there's a lot to read there, but if you're interested in sort of the dynamics of that relationship, it is a fascinating resource. So I highly recommend it. It's a fascinating insight into presidential diplomacy, which we don't often see. And if you're writing research papers, I highly recommend it too.
Your question, please.
I assume you have read the book by Earl Brower's grandson called Red Notice.
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, Red Notice, maybe I shouldn't have asked the question that way. Red Notice is a book about a fellow named Brower.
I know what happened.
Formed a company in Russia, and it was a investment company. And the results of his investment there ended up with his attorney. The Russians tried to steal the money that he had generated, and they ended up killing his Russian attorney. And the result of that was that the U.S. Congress, with Senator McCain being one of the big backers, established something, or rather voted on something called the Magnitsky Act.
The Magnitsky Act, yes.
Right. Barring about 13 Russians from coming to the United States. My question is, how can we, when we read the book, how can you possibly trust a lawless country to deal with internally, aside from the high level? How can at the level of the average person trust a person who will just pull the rug out from under your feet and law is not important?
I have not read the book. I have read quite a bit about Bill Browder. He does have a fascinating pedigree. His grandfather was the chairman of the American Communist Party. Look, in the early 2000s, there was no bigger Putin booster than Bill Browder. There was no bigger fan of Vladimir Putin's authoritarian kind of crackdown on the oligarchs, on the business community, and so on, than Bill Browder. When the unfortunate happened to him, and I give him a lot of credit for being certainly persistent and devoted to the cause, and what happened to this poor man, Magnitsky, it was a horrible fate. He died in prison. He was horribly abused there. It's just, at some point, somebody smuggled his diaries from that prison, and you just want to cry or scream as you read it. And on to the larger question of how can you deal with a criminal regime? Well, I don't know what to tell you. We seem to be dealing with a lot of criminal regimes the world over. Two wrongs don't make a right, or multiple wrongs don't make a right. But, you know, it's not a question of trusting the Russians on something like whatever issues they have, but pardon the old code, you know, trust but verify. We have on a number of issues very significant verification capabilities, and, you know, we were outraged, and some of us still are publicly, about the treatment of the Saudi Arabian journalist Khashoggi. Yet the administration, and I think its successors, will continue to deal with the Saudi government. Financial Times had a story, I think it was a few days ago. It was a lovely headline. The Saudi Arabia completes the anti-corruption campaign. Well, as to put it mildly, when they locked up dozens of their richest citizens in Ritz-Carlton prison in Riyadh and kept them there until they coughed up summarily something like $100+ billion, some of them apparently under considerable duress. I don't know. We can't always be. We don't need to be best friends with the Russians, but we can't pretend that Russia is not there, or we cannot sanction them out of existence.
Last question, please.
You were advocating a more rational policy towards Russia, if I understood you correctly.
I hope.
Yes. Well, I think many of us do hope. The question is, how is this possible? The last time we had a major rethink in our mutual relationships started really with Margaret Thatcher, who said, with Gorbachev, that is a man we may be able to do business with.
Yeah.
And it was President Reagan who did a Nixonian China trip, basically towards Russia, and really put us on a new elevation.
Yeah.
A totally new platform. We are in a different situation. Everything here at the moment, which has a stamp Russia on it, is basically a no-no. It's a kaput.
Yeah, toxic.
And
yeah.
It would be even more so in the remaining 2 years of this administration. And on the same time, we probably, after 2 years, we still will be dealing with the same person on the other side. So, give us a path how this desirable, rational policy is actually possible, even if we have more enlightened leadership in this country. Yeah. Just show me a path. Thank you.
Well, as I said, and I appreciate this is a very difficult issue. I don't know if I have a satisfactory answer for you, but let's just say you appoint me to be the next national security advisor for President Elizabeth Warren or Michael Bloomberg or whoever. I would begin with, and Putin, by the way, is going to be there until 2024, barring acts of God or something like that. He was just reelected in 2018 for a 6-year term. And being at a relatively young age, he may still be there, and he probably will be there after 2024 in some form or another, just not necessarily as president. I would begin, you know, I think step one is what we're trying to address here tonight, and that is answer our own questions about what we want from Russia, what we can and cannot accept, what constitutes our own interests. Maybe very difficult questions to answer, but I think we do need to answer them. And it doesn't have to be a final answer. It can be an evolving conversation, but we need to talk about this. Whereas now we're not talking in the toxic atmosphere that you very rightly referred to. I would reach out to Putin quietly with a personal message and begin to engage in a conversation. It doesn't need to be a summit where we become whoever it's going to be, Mike and Vladimir, or Liz and Vladimir, or something like that. I think we need to lower the expectations and begin to work through the issues that have accumulated. Appoint senior coordinator. I mean, I'm getting sort of into bureaucratic weeds, but I do think that you need to have this very high level, top level opening and engagement, because without it in Russia, nothing happens. And you need the president's personal attention to it. It's not going to produce miracles, but I think we need to re-engage. Right now, I think you're absolutely right. It's impossible to re-engage, because if Trump writes a letter to Putin, it will be immediately construed as, you know, he's asking for another skyscraper in Moscow or something like that. So, yeah, that's one of the unfortunate side effects of this investigation and the political scandal. But I can't think of another way. Thank you.